Good afternoon, everybody. Chancellor, distinguished... Yes, you're hiding up the back, but I spotted you. Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, and especially our contestants for today, welcome to the University of Melbourne's three-minute thesis competition final for 2012. My name's Shane Huntington, and I'll be your MC for today, so if anything goes wrong or you need to find an exit, please come to me. I'd also like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we're currently standing and sitting. I'd also like to pay respect to the elders, both past and present, of the Kulin Nation and extend respect to other Indigenous Australians that may be present. Now, before we go on, I should mention that it's a particular pleasure for me to come and speak to you as MC for this competition because I spend a large portion of my life teaching people how to communicate science. So to see these 12 people this year, I think we have, coming to give such an incredible display over a very short period of time to you of their not only their science skills, but also their communication skills is a particular pleasure for me to be a part of. And the person who can tell you a lot more about this is Professor Dick Strugmull, who I'll ask to say a few words to you now.
I'd probably like to read my little talk, but in the spirit of the 3MT, I won't make Simon happier. The genesis of this competition, I'll just talk a little bit about the genesis and a bit about what the 3MT is and perhaps a bit what it isn't. But the genesis of this competition, for those of you who don't know about it, I think probably had its history in the elevator pitch competitions that business schools used to run, you know, 10, 20 years ago, where the argument was that someone should be able to, in a very short space of time, convince an investor of what the genesis of their the origins of their ideas were, what it was going to do for them, and do this in a very succinct way. Now, that was adapted in a eureka moment by Professor Alan Lawson from University of Queensland, who was Dean of the Graduate School up there. And he developed this sort of broader concept of the 3MT, where all the contestants get access to a single slide, no transitions, and 3 minutes to tell you about their research. Okay, so what isn't the 3MT? The 3MT isn't about dumbing down research. It's not about diminishing the considerable research activities that are being done by this, you know, very able cohort. There are 5,000 graduate researchers at this university. They all have a story to tell, and we're only going to hear 12 of them today. But I would hope that all students at this university could get up and communicate to an educated audience what their research is about, what the value of it is, what it's going to do for humanity. Now, the University of Melbourne, when it trains graduate researchers, has a series of attributes that we ask those graduates to meet at the end of that candidature. And amongst those are things like the ability to initiate research and formulate viable research questions. But one of them is quite clearly the capacity to disseminate the results of research and scholarship by oral and written communication to a variety of audiences. So that's what we're testing today. The 12 finalists you have in front of you are a snapshot of the university. They're by no means the full width of what the university covers, and we shouldn't lose sight of that. They all have interesting projects. I've not heard any of the heats, but I know these contestants fought their way through the heats to get here today, so I'm expecting big things of everybody. Each contestant, as I said, will be given 3 minutes and one slide, and we have a timekeeper over here who will keep them to that time. I'll hand back now to Shane to take us through the competition.
Okay, so as many of you probably know, you have a part to play later today because we have a People's Choice Award. So I'll give you instructions on how to go about that later, but you will be able to vote for your favourite later on in the session. However, the more formal aspect requires us to have three of our judges. And we have someone you probably know well, Simon Clues, who's the director of the Writing Centre for Scholars and Researchers here at the University of Melbourne, and is one of our judges for several years. And I know gives a lot of feedback and help to all of our contestants. We also have an old colleague of mine, Dr. Andy Horvath, who is the senior creator of science communication at Melbourne Museum. And for about 15 years, Andy and I were broadcasting on Triple R together, the science program on Sunday mornings. So another person well-versed in science communication. And from a bit further afield is Professor Victoria Green, who's the Senior Associate Dean for Graduate Education, the College of Arts and Science at Vanderbilt University. So particular welcome to you, Victoria. Thank you for coming. Now, I would ask, before we bring our first contestant up, for everyone to please, please, please turn your phones onto silent if you haven't already done so. They only get 3 minutes, and usually it takes people about 30 seconds to realise their phone's ringing before they switch it off. So if you haven't done so already, please turn your phones off before we bring our first contestant up. Now, first in the line today is Andrew Watt. Andrew's from the Department of Pathology within the Faculty of Medicine, Dentistry and Health Sciences here at the University, and he'll be speaking about 20 years of Alzheimer's disease. Andrew?
Picture this. Your house is on fire and there's only time to save one thing. What do you save? Now, the funny thing is that whilst we'd all save different items from our homes, we would all invariably be saving the exact same thing. We would be saving a memory. For people with Alzheimer's disease, though, it's different. They don't get to choose which memory they'd save. They simply get to watch and hope that that memory survives a little longer. Now, most of you will already be somewhat familiar with Alzheimer's disease. Perhaps you know one of the 250,000 Australians currently diagnosed. Maybe you've heard that there are currently no effective treatments for the disease. Or maybe you even know of a small peptide called beta amyloid, or A-beta, which is thought to initiate the pathological changes in the brain. What you probably didn't know, however, was that subtle changes in beta amyloid, subtle changes in the brain, are already occurring some 20 years before a diagnosis can be made. That's 20 years before any memory impairments become readily apparent. Now, many of us will find this a terrifying notion, as it means that the silent destruction of our minds could be occurring in our 50s, our 40s, or maybe even our 30s. But rather than viewing this as a terrifying inevitability, I prefer to see these changes as providing us with a unique opportunity, a 20-year window in which to identify individuals at risk for Alzheimer's disease. And just how we identify these people is the focus of my research. So my work centres on the development of a predictive blood test for Alzheimer's disease. Now, a lot of work's already been done in this area, looking at A-beta levels in the blood. And to date, it's had limited success. But I think I may have figured out why. You see, whilst these investigations spend a lot of time stringently optimising the analytical aspects of their investigations, they seem to have neglected the earlier pre-analytical components, such as how they collect the samples or how those samples are stored. Now, as it would happen, A-beta is an incredibly fragile peptide, which means that subtle variations in these early stages, such as changing tube type or changing storage temperatures, can significantly alter the levels of A-beta we can see in the blood. So I'm currently working to optimise these pre-analytical stages before I begin an assessment of blood A-beta levels in a cohort of over 1,000 participants. It is hoped that by more rigorously controlling these early stages, we'll be better able to identify those individuals at risk and potentially even initiate preventative treatments which enable us to delay or maybe even avert a diagnosis of Alzheimer's from being made. So then one day maybe I can stand here and say, picture this. The fire's been averted and your memories are now safe. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. I think we'll all be thinking about what we're going to say from our burning down house for the rest of the day. Certainly, it's on my mind, but I suspect if I don't save my wife first, my wife won't be worth living. So here we go there. Our next contestant is Claire Wilkinson. Claire's from the School of Population Health in the Faculty of Medicine, Dentistry and Health Sciences. And Claire will be speaking about reducing the harm.
King's Cross, Sydney, an area full of bars, pubs and clubs. Last month, Thomas Kelly was on his way to his friend's 18th birthday party when he was king hit, fatally. How does Thomas's death relate to my PhD? Well, it's in the rapid policy response. Licensed venues are no longer able to sell shots, Elko Pops, and no more than 4 standard drinks can be purchased at a time. These are just some of the restrictions now placed on all the licensed venues in La Crosse. And that's 58 venues in the space the size of the University of Melbourne. So my PhD is examining the role of local councils in alcohol policy. In 2011, the Newcastle City Council required all pubs to close 1.5 hours earlier. So 5 a.m. became 3:30 a.m. And what they found was a 37% decrease in alcohol-related assaults. 37%. That's hugely significant. And it's not the kind of effect size we're used to seeing in population health. So why local councils? Well, from a community development perspective, councils are closest to the problem. From a legal perspective, to sell alcohol, you need a liquor license. Before you can get a liquor license, you need a planning permit. And it's the local councils that issue those planning permits. So my PhD is about examining the role of local councils in issuing those planning permits, as well as the conditions they place on them, such as opening hours, like in Newcastle. To do this, I'll be interviewing a range of people, including elected stakeholders, experienced council workers, local residents, and a range of key experts. Key questions include, how has the role of local councils in controlling alcohol changed over time? What effect have changes had on alcohol-related harms? And above all, what are effective powers for councils? Next year, I'm going to Finland, which is a country also experiencing alcohol-related problems, to look at how local governments there control the issue. I'll be staying at 2 research centres. When I return, the final stage of my research will be analysing all of my response data, identifying what makes effective policy, reducing the harm, reducing the deaths, like Thomas's. Thank you.
Thank you, Claire. Our next contestant is Kirsty Short. Kirsty is from the Department of Microbiology and Immunology in the Faculty of Medicine, Dentistry and Health Sciences. And Kirsty will be talking about otitis media, a pain in the ear. Thank you.
Thank you. Ear disease. This is something that has become so prevalent amongst Indigenous Australians that it has become integrated into the local culture. This picture depicts the fact that in some Indigenous communities, when a child is born, all the grandmothers go out and they collect up dragonflies. They then hold these dragonflies up to the ear of the child. If the child responds to the beating of the dragonfly's wings, they know that that child can hear and is therefore healthy. If the child does not respond, they know that that child suffers from hearing loss, most likely because of a disease called otitis media. So otitis media is essentially a middle ear infection, and this disease can be caused by different viruses and bacteria. Otitis media is most common amongst children, so many of you will have experienced it or have had kids who've experienced it as a bad middle earache. Unfortunately, otitis media can leave some children with permanent, lifelong hearing loss. As I told you, otitis media is a particular problem for Indigenous Australians. And part of this relates to the high rate of viral and bacterial infections experienced by these communities. One virus that's very important for otitis media is influenza virus, or the flu. However, whilst we know that the flu is really important in causing ear disease, we don't really understand how the virus is doing this. Thus, we don't really understand the best way in which to prevent ear disease, either amongst Indigenous or non-Indigenous kids. The aim of my PhD, therefore, was to use infant mice to understand how the flu causes ear disease. Essentially, I wanted to know why, for some Australian children, the flu could be such a pain in the ear. So what I found is that if you infect infant mice with the flu, the virus replicates really well in the ear. And this was a bit of a surprising finding, because we know that the virus replicates really well in the nose and the lungs. And that's why when kids get the flu, they get that lovely dripping nose and great hacking cough that keeps everybody up at night. But obviously, replicating in the ear has really important consequences for ear disease. The body's immune system or defense system then sends in all these cells to the ear to try and get rid of the infection. Unfortunately, these cells make the disease worse rather than better. And the mice, like many Indigenous kids, go on to develop hearing loss. So the final part of my PhD now is to use this new understanding of disease development to identify better treatment options for children with ear infections. Ultimately, I hope that my research will reduce the incidence of ear disease and ensure that every child gets to hear those dragonfly's wings. Thank you.
Thank you, Kirsty. They have such small little ears, those mice too, don't they? It's like, wonder how they, yeah, so small. Our next contestant is Margaret Lamb. Margaret is from the Department of Microbiology and Immunology in the Faculty of Medicine, Dentistry and Health Sciences. And Margaret will be talking about bad bugs on the rise in hospitals, getting to know the enemy.
There is a silent and invisible killer on the prowl, and it's lurking in hospitals worldwide. For many sick patients who find themselves hospitalised with hopes of getting better, the last thing they'd expect is to acquire a new infection during their stay. Unfortunately, this is the bleak reality faced by millions of patients each year who end up with hospital infections caused by hospital superbugs. These superbugs are bacteria that have become resistant to many types of antibiotics and are notoriously difficult to eradicate. By now, you'll have noticed the graph and the lack of accompanying labels. And this is because the graph actually represents one of several recent and worrying trends: an increase in the number of patients with hospital infections, an increase in the number of deaths caused by hospital superbugs, and an increase in the billions of dollars already spent by the health sector to try and keep these superbugs at bay. But today, I'll be speaking about yet another increasing trend, and that is the rise of a superbug called VRE. VRE, short for vancomycin-resistant enterococci, a bacteria that causes several types of infections, ranging from the relatively mild intra-abdominal and urinary tract infections to the more severe and often life-threatening heart valve and bloodstream infections. My research focuses on understanding the VRE situation at one of Victoria's major hospitals, which had experienced a significant increase in VRE infections in recent years. The majority of these infections were caused by one of two distinct VRE types, the ST17 type VRE or the ST203 VRE strains. While the ST17 type dominated earlier on, it's actually the recent emergence of these ST203 strains that are responsible for the overwhelming majority of these infections. So my PhD aims to understand how these ST203 strains have emerged, and what are the key differences between the two groups that have allowed these ST203 strains to become more super than the ST17s. Now, take a look at the person sitting next to you, and you'll see an obvious difference in your appearances. This difference arises not just because of how you dress or how you groom yourselves, but because of your DNA. Just like how there are DNA sequence differences that set you apart from the person next to you, there are also DNA sequence differences that distinguish the ST17 from the ST203 VRE strains. And it'll be finding these differences in my PhD that will be the key to understanding and addressing the rise of VRE. Superbug numbers are on the rise, and in this war we fight against them, DNA-based research like mine is crucial for scoping out the enemy. I hope that research like mine will one day reverse the trends depicted in this graph, where we'll see a decline in the costs, but more importantly, a decline in the number of infections and deaths caused by these killer superbugs. Thank you.
Thank you, Margaret, and I'll give you about $5 later to tell me which hospital you're talking about. Our next contestant, and we're almost at the halfway mark, folks, it's exciting, is Matt Bird. He's from the Department of Pediatrics in the Faculty of Medicine, Dentistry and Health Sciences, and I promise we do have people from other faculties that are coming up. And the topic he has for you today is food for thought.
Come, step back with me. 2 billion years in time to witness the most remarkable of relationships developing. Deep under the surface of the ocean, a hydrogen-producing bacterium was getting into bed with a methane-belching ancient type of cell called an archaea. The archaea embraced the bacteria, engulfing it whole. Now, this might sound like a bad romance, but 2 billion years later, this is a living arrangement that makes up all your human cells. You see, the bacteria actually moved inside the archaea and now live there happily, like a seed within an avocado, and are known as mitochondria. The word mitochondria actually in part comes from the Greek word for seed, as that's what they look like when first seen down a microscope. Now, each of your human cells doesn't actually just have one mitochondria, but hundreds. Each of those mitochondria is performing critical jobs for the cell, like telling cells how to talk to each other, when to die, and perhaps most importantly, converting food that we eat into a useful form of energy for the body. How they do this is fascinating. They break down the food and use it to charge themselves, creating something much like a battery. They then use this battery to drive a motor which spins around, powering the cell. Unfortunately, this process is broken in about 1 in 5,000 newborn babies, with devastating consequences. It spells particular trouble for the organs that need a lot of energy. So that's the muscle, the heart, the liver, and the brain. It is the focus of my research project to understand what is happening in the brains of these children with broken mitochondria. To do this, we have a mouse which can't charge its mitochondrial battery properly. What I have found is that these mice can't get enough energy for their brains when we give them certain types of food, but are interestingly okay with others. I have also found that they produce more of a dangerous type of molecule called oxidants, which can cause a lot of damage to cells. It's these same dangerous oxidants that we all consume copious amounts of red wine, green tea, and dark chocolate to defend ourselves from. I hope this information can be used by doctors to help these children with broken mitochondria to improve their quality of life. This might be a case of food for thought. Feeding the children certain types of food like fatty avocados to get more energy for their brains. It also contains a warning though, that encouraging their brains to make more mitochondria, as has been one popular treatment strategy, might be dangerous if that means producing more of those dangerous oxidants. Keeping the kiddies dosed up on red wine probably isn't appropriate either though. I'm thinking dark chocolate. Thank you.
Well, this has made me really hungry. I'm not sure about you guys. The avocado is bad enough. The dark chocolate, I'm gone. Okay. Our next contestant is Melinda Kong, and as promised, not from the medical faculty. Melinda is from Language and Literacy Education from the Melbourne Graduate School of Education, and she's talking about study abroad, bilingual teachers' expectations, experiences, and identities.
Some of you here do not speak English as your first language. Imagine if you were actually a teacher of English in your home country, but now were studying abroad in an English-speaking country, such as Australia. Others have problems with your English and your accent. Outside class, you work as a waitress in a restaurant. You expected to improve your English, but you were insulted by an Italian cook who asked, "You know no English, eh?" These were the experiences of Thin La, a university lecturer from Vietnam when she was studying here. Thin La is one of the many bilingual teachers, or English teachers who do not speak English as their first language. They make up a total of 80% of English teachers worldwide. They teach more than 400 million speakers of English as a second language. In this era of globalization, many of these teachers are obtaining their postgraduate degrees from English-speaking countries. However, most teacher training programs focus on providing academic qualifications to them. Not much attention is given to their expectations, experiences outside class, and identity construction. This means how they view themselves as speakers and teachers of English. My study explores these neglected areas because they are important to help us understand bilingual teachers' development as English language teachers. I also hope to increase an awareness of the struggles that these teachers face, both inside and outside the classroom in an English-speaking country. For these purposes, I interviewed and emailed bilingual teachers who are pursuing the postgraduate degrees in teaching English when they were here in Australia. I looked at the impact of their expectations and experiences on how they construct their identities. I found that my participants had all kinds of experiences, both inside and outside the classroom, both good and bad. However, all the experiences were useful to their identity construction as teachers of English. This is because they actively link their expectations with what they learn inside class and what they experience outside class. Ladies and gentlemen, do you understand my English and my accent? If you do, why do I and teachers such as Stinla feel inferior to those of you who use English as your first language? My study suggests that programs and teacher educators need to empower or boost the self-confidence of bilingual teachers such as Stinla and I. More importantly, they should consider our expectations, experiences, and identities. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to be very careful how I pronounce everyone's names from this point because they are getting harder as we go along. Very conscious of it. Our next contestant is Naya McFadden from the School of Culture and Communications in the Faculty of Arts. And Naya will be talking about New Horror.
Does this image bother you? Question why? You're looking at a steak. It's just a steak. If you saw the same steak in a supermarket, you might buy it, make yourself a delicious meal. But next to the word horror, this image becomes problematic. It caused so much trouble, it was banned as a movie poster and almost considered too controversial for you to think about today. Because that's what horror does. It makes us think, and not just about what's easy. I think that horror has a renewed power to challenge and change how we think about everything in the 21st century West. My thesis is on New Horror. That's a name given to a prolific, profitable, and powerful movement of films that have emerged in the last 10 years. I focus on three subgenres that have had huge critical and commercial success. Those are torture, found footage, and zombie stories. Part of the power of New Horror is in its ability to take all of these themes and move them outside of the cinema space. And now they confront us online, in news, in advertising, TV, games, apps, and even in live performances. Horror is everywhere. And the question I always get is why? What makes horror so important to us now? I think it's because horror challenges two of the most important issues in the 21st century West, and those are terror and the screen. Now, when I say terror, of course all of us think of 9/11, but the word is now how we discuss all kinds of issues relating to disaster, to violence, to paranoia, and any us and them mentality that exists today. Now, of course, horror loves to deal with these themes, but when it does so, it often does it in much more subversive ways than we see in our mainstream narratives. Now, terror, like so much of our world, is something most of us have only experienced through screens. Screens are a part of our everyday lives. We have camera screens, we have phone screens, we have computers, televisions, cinema screens, and we even have the screen behind me. All of these screens mediate and reframe how we think about the world and how we think about news and entertainment. Now, horror plays with this by making us think about what's real and what's fictional and how our fears operate in those spaces. For instance, you might find yourself asking, is found footage of a zombie apocalypse any more fictional than weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? Horror is more than just entertainment. It's critical, it's interrogative, it's self-aware, it's confronting, and it's subversive. And when we watch horror, all of these things start to come out in us. We learn new ways to apply all of these skills to all of the media in our lives. We question what's fact, we question what's fiction, what's violence, what it means to watch it, what we think of as real, and who we are when we watch all of these things. New horror gives us the ability to question everything, from terrorists on the news to a picture of a piece of steak. And that's what makes new horror so important. It doesn't give us any answers, but it makes us ask some very dangerous questions. Thank you.
Still hungry? I'm still hungry for the chocolate. I'm just not really big on the steak. Our next contestant is Samantha Litka, and she's going to be speaking about carrots that really improve your eyesight. An all-diamond bionic eye. She's from the Department of Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering in the Melbourne School of Engineering.
Ever wonder if carrots really improve your eyesight? Well, maybe some carrots of diamond can. I have a vision for a bionic eye fully encased in diamond. The Australian Bionic Eye is already nearly a reality. Just 3 weeks ago, we announced that Diane Ashworth, profoundly blind for 20 years, has been successfully implanted with one of our prototypes, and she's already reported seeing shapes of light. So, how does a bionic eye work? Well, there are some diseases, like macular degeneration, which cause the death of the light-sensitive cells in our retina. That leaves behind a lot of other nerve cells in the eye that just aren't receiving any information. And we can implant a small chip onto those cells in the eye to give them the information they crave in the form of electrical pulses. And the more spots we can zap, the better the picture, like pixels on a screen. So far, so good, right? But we've all heard the phone dropped in the toilet story. So wouldn't the chip just fizzle out in the wet environment of the eye? To combat this, bionic implants are put into a small titanium can to prevent water getting in and toxic stuff getting out. To get the electric current out, a hole is drilled in the can, a wire threaded through, and the hole plugged up with ceramic. Now that's okay if you have a few wires, but for bionic vision, we want thousands of pixels, so the risk of a leak becomes too great. It's a major challenge facing the industry today, and it's what I decided to do my PhD on. Reading around the literature, I got really excited about synthetic diamond. It's grown in what's basically a huge microwave. It's biocompatible and totally resistant to degradation by the body. Pure diamond is electrically insulating, but by adding lots of nitrogen, we can make some areas conducting. That means instead of drilling a hole in the can and plugging it up again, we can simply make part of the wall conducting. The tricky part, however, is getting the chip encased inside the diamond. That was my innovation, and the patent is still in the works. Previously, engineers grew the synthetic diamond directly on the chip in the big microwave. But the temperatures in there can get up to 1,000 degrees, and the chip can't handle that either. Wouldn't it be better, I thought, to grow the diamond first and seal it around the chip later? So I took pre-grown blocks of synthetic diamond and cut it into small squares with a hollow in the middle, fit the chip inside, and found the right materials and techniques to seal it up leak tight. The finished product is totally leak-proof, relatively cheap, and as the adage goes, diamonds are forever. My diamond technology is now being incorporated into the overall bionic eye design. A blind person with a diamond bionic eye will have their vision restored for years. And wouldn't that put a twinkle in their eye?
Anyone in the room drop their phone into a toilet? I actually dropped mine into a dog bath. And I took it back to the shop and I said to the guy, it's not working. And he said, you didn't get it wet, did you? And I said, mate, it's not like a shower with it. He gave me a new one.
This is
Our, oh, hello, Optus. Our next contestant is Sandra Martig. She's from the Veterinary Hospital Equine Centre in the Faculty of Veterinary Science, and we'll be talking about racing until a bone breaks. Thank you.
This horse is Lion Tamer. He was one of the early favourites of last year's Melbourne Cup, yet he never made it to Cup Day. In fact, he broke a leg during the Cox Plate, and because of the severity of that injury, he needed to be euthanized. That was a flat race. There was no accident, not even a misstep, yet a broken leg. Have you ever wondered how this happens? These fractures are severe form of stress fractures. They account for about two-thirds of all deaths of racehorses on a track. They develop because tiny little cracks accumulate in a horse's bones with each step it takes at fast-speed gallop. Cracks so tiny, they don't hurt. Cracks so tiny, there's no test to see them in a live horse. Yet, in high numbers, These quacks are powerful enough to break a bone. As there is no easily accessible and cheap test to diagnose these injuries early on, and treatment is expensive and often impossible, the best way to approach these fractures is prevention. We know that these quacks can heal if the horse is given a rest before there are too many of them. The question is, when is it time for that rest? Currently, trainers answer that question based on their experience, together with a little bit of guesswork. But wouldn't it be great if they'd had a computer model which helped them making that decision more precisely? And in order to develop such a computer model, we need to know the mechanical properties of a horse's bones. And that's where my research comes into play. I investigate those mechanical properties. Such work can only be done in a lab, and I use horses of bones that died for reasons unrelated to my study. I apply different forces to the bones and count how often I can apply them before they break. Each force corresponds to a different speed of gallop. The relationship between the different forces and how often I could apply them can be expressed in a mathematical formula. This formula in turn can be used in a computer model. Now, the model needs to be individualized, taking into account each horse's age and its previous training history. But we feel that if we take all that information together, we can develop a tool which helps the trainers to decide whether there are too many cracks in a horse's bones and it needs a rest, or whether it can continue racing safely, so that in the future, fewer horses will need to be euthanized on the racetrack and tragedies like lion tamers can be prevented. Thank you.
Okay, Sarah, you need to hurry up with your research because the spring carnival is upon us. Our next contestant is Sarah Cieszelski. I hope I did that justice. From the School of Languages and Linguistics in the Faculty of Arts. And Sarah will be talking about Learning to be a Sherpa, Children, Language and Culture on the Roof of the World.
Imagine you were born just a few days' walk from Mount Everest. Like other Sherpa children, you were named after the day of the week you were born and wrapped in a yak wool blanket to protect you from the freezing cold. You grow up in the Nepal Himalayas, 4 kilometres above sea level, working alongside your parents in the rocky potato fields. You learn to practice the most ancient form of Tibetan Buddhism and to speak your native Sherpa language. And interwoven with the language you're learning are the Sherpa cultural traditions that enfold you just as snugly as that yak wool blanket. Sherpa is not a job description. In fact, the Sherpas are an ethnic group, famous for their toughness, mountaineering skills, and ability to drink huge quantities of yak butter tea. I went to live with the Sherpas 3 times over 2 years to find out how their children learn language. Most early child language research was done on European languages, especially English, which made the conclusions limited or even wrong. Doing fresh research in little studied communities helps us cast off these limitations and make our theories truly universal. Sherpa child language had never been studied before I trekked up that mountain and set up my video camera. I filmed 6 kids between 2 and 4 years old going about their daily routine. And I found something very unusual. What these children heard was command after command after command. Desho, come here. Tok, go there, sit still. Dijusa, wash this. Unlike us, Sherpa parents gave direct orders, and often these came so fast that the kids had no chance of obeying, even if they'd wanted to. These commands actually held cultural information. The older you are, the more right you have to boss other people around. So then, when a 4-year-old played with a 2-year-old, the older child gave just as many commands to the younger one as her parents did to her. She'd learned this cultural information about status and was reproducing it perfectly. This research could turn some of our established child language theories on their heads. But more practically, the assumptions I'm trying to overturn are the exact same assumptions that underpin our education systems. Kids from different backgrounds who don't know these hidden cultural codes risk falling behind everyone else. and that disadvantage is extremely hard to recoup. My work can help make us more sensitive to all children's needs, whether they start life in a disposable nappy, strapped into a sarong, or wrapped in a yak wool blanket. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. Those of you who have been keeping count will realise we have gone past the halfway mark. That statement's true. I mean, you think about it. Our next presenter is Sheridan Lang. She is from the Department of Mechanical Engineering in the Melbourne School of Engineering, and Sheridan will be talking about low-cost limbs at the turn of a tap.
Ladies and gentlemen, do you remember how you got to your seat? You walked up a tiered corridor, down railless stairs, and manoeuvred yourself into your low-set chair. Now imagine doing so with only one leg. Daily obstacles such as railless stairs are a reality for over 20,000 Australian amputees. However, as Australians, they receive the highest quality of care and state-of-the-art prosthetics. They can live a relatively normal life. This is not the situation for the 500,000 amputees living in Southeast Asia. Below knee prosthetics are made up of three components: the socket, the shank, and the foot. The socket is the most important of the components, determining the comfort and the fit for the amputee. However, given the uniqueness of each amputee stump, it is also the most difficult to manufacture. Traditional manufacture techniques rely not on the use of high-tech machines, but on the hands of the prosthetist. They apply knowledge and skills learned over a 5-year university degree to mould each socket to each amputee's stump. The technique is hugely successful. However, it's also highly reliant on the skill and experience of the prosthetist. My research revolves around a novel technique to mould sockets called pressure casting, or PCAST. The aim of the PCAST technique is to minimise this reliance on the prosthetist, making it ideal for developing countries like Cambodia and Vietnam, where there's a shortage of skilled and qualified prosthetists, and yet an abnormally high number of amputees due to war, landmine, and traffic accidents. During the PCAST technique, the patient places their stump, wrapped in plaster, into the PCAST tank. At the turn of a tap, water enters the tank until the pressure is sufficient to support half of their weight. At this point, the water pressure then works to uniformly push and mould the plaster till it's the exact shape of the amputee's stump. After 2 or 3 minutes, or less time than it takes me to finish this speech, it's done. Essentially, if you can turn a tap, you can mould a socket. The PCAST tank is completely portable, it's inexpensive to manufacture, and it requires only running water to operate. To date, we've cast 50 Vietnamese amputees with PCAST sockets. Testing has shown that they have levels of functionality and satisfaction equal to that of amputees in Australia. Now, there's not too much that I can do about the landmines, the war, the traffic accidents, and the birth defects that are causing these amputations. But what we can work towards is providing comfortable and well-designed prosthetics so that amputees in developing nations, just like those in Australia, can live with restored functionality, increased employment opportunities, and improved self-worth, and that they too can navigate everyday obstacles such as a tiered corridor, a railless staircase, or a low-set chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheridan. Lucky last. Simon Crouch is from the School of Population Health within the Faculty of Medicine, Dentistry and Health Sciences. And Simon will be talking about Pride and Prejudice, child health and well-being in same-sex families.
Disgusting. It's not a very nice word. It might even make you feel uncomfortable. And you're probably wondering what it has to do with this cute little boy on the screen behind me. Well, let me introduce you to Riley. Fortunately, he doesn't require a prosthetic limb. His eyesight is just fine, and he's never had a hospital-acquired infection. Riley is a bright and bubbly 3-year-old boy who, in terms of his health and well-being, is just the same as any other ordinary child. But if you were to ask Riley who his mummy is, which has happened on a number of occasions, he's more than likely to reply very proudly, "My mummy's name is Daddy." You see, Riley doesn't have a mummy. He has two daddies. Now, some would suggest that this isn't a healthy way to raise a child. And one woman at a recent rally in Canberra described people like Riley's parents as disgusting. After all, God created Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. In spite of these attitudes, however, thousands of children in Australia are growing up with same-sex attracted parents. What we know already about these children is that they are doing well in many aspects of their lives. But same-sex families encounter discrimination, and when they do, it is often the children who are most affected. Research so far has been somewhat limited, as it has focused only on lesbian parents and very small numbers of children. So, what I am doing now is looking at Australian children under the age of 18 years with gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered parents. I'm really interested in their complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and in particular, the impact that discrimination has on them. I'm using both parent and child surveys, as well as family interviews, to gather these experiences, and my research is the first to capture the voices of the children themselves. I already have information on over 400 children, and what these early results suggest is that these kids are indeed scoring well on many measures. But some of the children have described to me how deeply affected they are when they hear comments like, "Your parents are disgusting." At 3 years old, Riley's proud to have two dads, and I hope that he's one of those children who grows up to be happy and healthy. But just this week, we have heard a number of Australian senators demonstrate their prejudiced views about same-sex families, and some of their comments really were disgusting. That's why my research is so important, as it will help to inform politicians, teachers, healthcare workers, or anyone who meets children like Riley, so that they can better understand same-sex families. Only then can these children enjoy their pride, free from prejudice. Thank you.
Thank you, Simon. I think it's always good for us as a society to look at the things that one day our society will be ashamed of and think about what that means in every context. Have I missed anyone? No? Good. We now have to give our judges some time to deliberate and to bring their scores together. We are fortunate that we have Erica and Tristan from the Melbourne Conservatorium of Music to provide them with some thinking music, which should help them to deliberate. Okay, the thinking music worked a treat, folks. They came to a very good decision, I think. That we'll all be happy with. I did want to mention that this is live streamed, this event today, and last year, this particular event generated 29,000 minutes of viewing time. And that means either one person watched it over and over again, or 29,000 people watched the last minute. Dick has not been able to explain this to me in a reasonable way, but it means a lot. I should also mention that our previous two winners for the University of Melbourne are in the audience. I might get them to stand up if they are here and just give us a wave. Told you I'd point you out. Now, we of course today are awarding four prizes in total, a first, second and third, and the People's Choice Award, which you have been hopefully voting for furiously, and I see some people with slight RSI looking hands, so I know that's been happening. I'm going to ask Professor Dick Strugmore to come up to present these awards as they are given. Firstly, could you please join me in applauding all of our contestants today who I think did a fantastic job. We could string this out for half an hour if you want, but we won't. In third place today, from the Faculty of Medicine, Dentistry and Health Sciences, that narrows it down. The School of Population Health, narrows it down a bit further. Speaking on the topic of Pride and Prejudice was Simon Crouch. Okay. In second place, from the Department of Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering, speaking on the topic of carrots that really improve your eyesight, an all-diamond bionic eye, Samantha Lister. Okay. Now then, the first place winner for the University of Melbourne from our grand final today is from the Faculty of Arts. Has everyone worked it out? It is Sarah Shishelsky. Dick to hold on to the Peter McPhee Cup. It does have the previous two winners' names etched onto it, and we'll have Sarah's as well. Congratulations, Sarah. Thank you. Now, Professor Strugman also informs me that we have some certificates and book vouchers for all of our runners-up for today. So I might get you to just hand those out, Dick. Or you can come up and grab them. Come up and grab them.
Yep.
I'm now going to ask one of my colleagues from 3RRR, Jacinta Parsons, to come up and hand out the People's Choice Award and announce it.
RRR is really proud to be part of this competition and this award. The People's Choice Award is obviously the most important one, as it is representing the capacity for this great academic research to reach the layman. I represent the layman. And it's wonderful on my show.
Put this on you.
Oh, sorry. I'll start again. Do you want me to dance while we're waiting? Hi.
It is great to be here again to award the People's Choice Award. Every fortnight on my show on a Wednesday morning, I invite a PhD student to come on and to talk to me and to our very wide audience about the amazing research that happens in universities. Dr. Shane does the same thing on his show, and Dr. Andy over here is also involved in making sure that this research doesn't stay in the academic bubble, but gets out to where it needs to get out and have the conversations that need to happen. Without further ado, or time, or whatever, to award the People's Choice Award from the Department of Mechanical Engineering, low-cost limbs at a turn of a tap, Sheridan Lang. Congratulations. Very good. Well done. That there, we're going to turn in front of the screen. Very good. That's it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jacinta. Okay, we are close to the end, folks, but I think it's very important to acknowledge that during the period in which this group has been getting to this point today, they have no doubt inflicted an incredible amount of grief on their family, friends, colleagues, while they've practiced these presentations in, shall we say, a less perfect way. So we thank them for all their support. I'd also like to thank their supervisors for helping them to do this and congratulate them all on becoming grand finalists. We'd also like, yeah. Although she wrote this list and didn't put her name on it, I'd also like to thank Holly Bracken for all her work. And Marcus, who was here before, who I'm told surname is the timekeeper. Thank you, Marcus, if you're still around. To all of the judges who've given up their time freely over the last few months, in particular, Dr. Jason Gaber, Richard Salas, Professor Marshall Lighthouse, Professor Alison Lewis, Rebecca Hobden, Associate Professor James Bailey, Dr. John Hattie, in particular, who've been part of all the semifinals coming up till now, and in particular to our judges today, Simon Clues, Andy Horvath, and Vicky Green, who's come such a long way. Thank you very much for your efforts. This competition doesn't happen without a lot of support. Much of that comes from the Melbourne School of Graduate Research, from the Writing Centre for Scholars and Researchers, from Academic Skills, notably Steve Campitelli, and from the University of Melbourne's Knowledge Partnerships Group. And in fact, there's a Cultural and Community Relations Advisory Group grant that helps support the program today. We're going to get these guys here to stick around for a couple of photographs, but I would invite all of you outside. We have some refreshments if you'd please join us, and thank you very much for attending and supporting them today. Thank you.